Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. First Nations veterans are remembered for their contributions in the World Wars as well as the War of 1812. The Shilkotin Nation has celebrated the federal government's rejection of Taseko's proposed prosperity mine, but will be keeping an eye on the situation. Energy and transmission are the new casinos for First Nations in Ontario. That's according to the president of the Lake Huron Anishinaabeg Transmission Company. The chair of Trent University's Indigenous Studies Department wasn't surprised with the results of a recent survey that found only a fraction of people polled answered that Indigenous nations played a key role in founding this country. And Nipissing First Nation in Ontario is home to a new gem in the community. An arts studio has recently celebrated its grand opening and plans to showcase local talent. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way after the news. Here's your National Aboriginal News. First Nations veterans in Saskatchewan are working to mark all the graves of forgotten First Nations soldiers. Although federal law dictates that the government pay for the headstones of any veteran who has been dead for more than 5 years, there are more than 200 former Saskatchewan First Nation military personnel in unmarked graves. The Grave Marker Program is one of several projects coming out of the Saskatchewan First Nations Veterans Association. Additional projects from the association includes a speakers bureau and a website to list the biographies of the First Nations soldiers. But education about First Nation participation in the World Wars could be better. In Ontario, Anishinaabeg Nation spokesperson Morris Switzer says there's an education initiative in the province. He says a chapter on First Nation veterans will be included in a new textbook.
I can tell you that the content of those texts is pretty thorough about the role that First Nations and Aboriginal warriors have played in keeping Canada sovereign and safe. And but again, these things are overdue, but it's never too late. And we can't overlook these really important parts in our history.
The First Nations textbooks could be out in about 2 years. Meanwhile, November 8th marked the 6th annual First Nations Veterans Day in Canada. In Vancouver, over 100 people marched downtown to honor First Nations soldiers. Most people said in a recent national poll that the British were the principal founders of Canada. The poll of 1,500 Canadians was commissioned by the Montreal-based Association for Canadian Studies. But the study also showed French and English-speaking citizens have different views of about who is responsible for creating the country. Despite that, it is noted that there are many Indigenous nations across the country who had occupied Canada long before the arrival of the European colonizers. In the survey, 42% said the British were principal founders of Canada, 20% chose the French, and only 18% answered that Indigenous nations played a key role. David Newhouse is the chair of Indigenous Studies at Trent University, and he didn't bat an eye at the findings.
It's not surprising, right? I mean, we firmly believe, or at least the two founding nations idea of Canada has been around for a very long time. And so most Canadians are taught that the country was founded by the British and the French. And so that's the idea that's taught in public school, that's the idea that's taught in high school, and it's only when people come to university that they begin to have at least that challenge. But that idea is still very, very strong. What is surprising is that there is at least a sense now that Aboriginal people have played a role. Right? I mean, 20%, so one out of five people now say that Aboriginal people played a role in the founding of Canada. And so I think that's quite interesting. I think that represents quite a shift.
But of the younger people polled, that number rose to 25%. So Newhouse says there's also been a shift in younger people's thinking.
The study also indicates that young people are more inclined to give a larger role to Aboriginal people than older people. So I think that's quite interesting as well, and I think that's quite important. So our ideas about how the country has been founded and who are the founding peoples of the country are I think, beginning to shift.
Jack Jedwa, executive director of the Association for Canadian Studies, says that result raises the question of whether the latest cohort of students is being offered a version of history that directs more attention at the founding role of First Nations in Canada. The survey was conducted earlier this month by Leger Marketing. 11 people are vying for the top spot of Nunavut Tungavik Incorporated. Elections are slated for December 13th for the territory's Inuit Land Claims Organization. The winner of next month's election will replace Paul Kalajak, who was fired late last month amid concerns about the use of his corporate credit card. He had almost completed serving a two-month suspension when NTI members voted to remove him as president. The board had suspended him because it said Kalajak had racked up just over $50,000 on his corporate credit card. The new president of NTI will serve the rest of Kulajak's term, which runs until December 2012. Thelma Rio has pleaded guilty to being an accessory in the 1975 kidnapping of Anna Mae Aquash. Aquash was an American Indian Movement activist from Nova Scotia. Rio has pleaded guilty 3 weeks before she was to go on trial related to Aquash's murder. 65-year-old Rios admitted in court that she had relayed a message in December 1975 to fellow AIM members in Colorado. That message included information that 30-year-old Aquash was to be brought from Denver to Rapid City. Rios also admitted she had let her apartment be used for purposes related to Anna Mae. Aquash's body was found in the Badlands in February 1976. The Mi'kmaq woman had been shot in the head, execution style. Rios' co-defendant, 54-year-old John Graham, is still scheduled for trial November 29th on four murder-related charges, including rape. Rios may testify at Graham's trial, and if convicted, he would face life in prison. One other man had been convicted for his role in Aquash's murder. Arlo Looking Cloud was convicted in 2004, while Richard Marshall was acquitted of murder charges in his trial last spring. The Minister of Indian Affairs sees through rose-colored glasses. First Nations see substantially high unemployment rates, undrinkable water, moldy houses, teen suicide, and much depression. But according to the Toronto Star, that's not how John Duncan sees it. He told the Star there's been much progress and things are moving in a very good direction. However, Sean Atleo, the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, disagrees with the Minister of Indian Affairs. Atleo says the situation on many reserves is dire and is renewing his call on Harper to help come up with a meeting to move beyond the Indian Act. Those comments come after a Toronto Star investigation into Canada's broken Indian Act system. The Star also found that Indian Affairs' own staff had jumped from 3,300 in 1995 to more than 5,100 today. Nearly $1 billion of Indian Affairs' $7 billion budget is being used to cover the bureaucracy's own operating expenses. The investigation by the newspaper also found that a quarter of First Nations were in financial trouble and crises on many reserves and has become the meal ticket for the Indian industry. The Indian industry, according to the Star, is an army of consultants and lawyers who are sucking hundreds of millions of dollars out of First Nations and from federal government coffers. Anishinaabe communities in Ontario halted traffic on a highway leading to Sault Ste. Marie on November 8th. The communities were holding an education rally. Garden River Chief Lyle Sayers says education is a right under the 1850 treaty and it's not a privilege. There are concerns about the growing gap between what the federal government provides and what students actually need for an adequate education. There is also a growing gap between what the province's school system charges First Nations students and what the federal government provides for students who live on reserve. Cindy Fisher, president of the Ontario Native Education Counseling Association, questions that gap. She wonders how Canada can find the money to pay school boards but can't find the money for education on reserve. AFN National Chief Sean Atleo, Chiefs of Ontario Regional Chief Angus Toulouse, and Anishinaabeg Nation Grand Council Chief Patrick Madabi also participated in the rally. The Shilkotin Nation in BC is breathing a sigh of relief after the federal government rejected the proposed Prosperity Mine from Taseko Mining. Chief Joe Alphonse says the people can now continue with their way of life.
I think it means a lot. I think it, you know, means relief immediately. The threat of our culture, the threat of our fish stocks being destroyed, our water becoming contaminated, and you know, big industry doesn't always bring in the big jobs that everybody thinks and hopes it's going to bring, it, but it will bring an increase in social issues and stuff like that. So, you know, what does it mean for Chilcotin people? I think it means a lot. It means it's very positive that it's not going through and can continue to rely on our waters, our fish, continue with our way of life, be able to hunt moose, deer, and continue with that kind of that way of life without fear that we're going to become contaminated ourselves.
The Minister of State for Mining, Randy Hawes, had told media that he doesn't think the project is totally dead and wants to have another look at it. Alphonse didn't read too much into that statement.
Well, saving face. I think, they have to say something. Otherwise, their markets are falling through the floor. It's more of a statement to keep the investor interest than anything else. Prosperity Mine is dead, and there's nothing they can do to revive that now.
Alphonse says the community held a gathering November 4th to celebrate the federal government's decision not to go ahead with the mine. Energy and Transmission will be the new casinos for First Nations in Ontario. That from John Bokash, president of the Lake Huron Anishinaabeg Transmission Company. Bokash says the transmission company was founded as an answer to aging transmission lines in the province, as well as create wealth for First Nation communities. He says the company can also help with First Nation wind power projects.
We know that there's some major projects in the planning phase right now within Anishinaabeg territory. And if we have an Anishinaabeg transmission company and perhaps an Anishinaabeg services company to build lines, we know that we can work really well together, and that rather than the jobs to somebody else, we can keep the jobs in our communities. And I think that's one of the long-term goals that we all have.
The Lake Huron Anishinaabeg Transmission Company is owned by several First Nations along the shores of Lake Huron. Bokash says the company is about 18 months away from becoming a designated transmitter in Ontario. The government in Australia is planning to hold a referendum within 3 years on amending its constitution to acknowledge Aborigines as the first Australians. Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard made the announcement November 8th. A panel will be appointed soon, which will report to the government next year on the wording for the referendum. More than 10 years ago, though, a referendum was defeated that would have added a preamble to the constitution honoring Aborigines as the nation's first people. The Prime Minister is hoping the vote on the new referendum will take place during the next general election in late 2013.
A long, 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 long time ago, upon this ground, born from the cosmos, came Stargirl. Something like the creation story, only the Earth was already there, and she just left.
The arts have long been a way of life for First Nations, and Nipissing First Nation in Ontario is home to a new gem. A family has held its grand opening of an arts studio. Penny Cucci is a dancer, actor, teacher, and choreographer and member of Nipissing First Nation. She says the family moved to the community to promote the arts and local artists, which will be the main function of Big Medicine Studio.
We moved here to Nipissing, my husband and I and our two kids, about 4 years ago, and with the aim of doing work in the community, with bringing arts, what we're doing in the arts to this community, but also with the aim of seeking out those other artists that are already in the community and collaborating with them. And so, in the time that we've been here, one of the big needs for us was to have a place for that, have a home for that. So built this studio to do dance and to do theater and to do the work that we're hoping to do in the future.
The family brought in a mentor for 2 weeks before the grand opening. Mariel Miguel is the artistic director of Spider-Woman Theater, which was founded in 1975 and is the longest-running Native American fest theater group in North America. And she's quite proud of the family.
I think they are brave. They are very brave young people. They have put together their careers with their culture and their families. And to me, that's really brave. It means that you do the whole circle. And sometimes it happens together. Sometimes it's piecemeal. And I think it's wonderful, that that they have this Big Medicine Studio.
The grand opening of Big Medicine Studio was held November 5th. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
As the world turns around, love is lost and found in many different ways. You'll know when your day comes and find that special one that's meant to be. You'll wonder just how long to keep love growing strong. This is what it takes, more than words can say. The warmth of a smile, feel of a kiss, a little hug of sweet tenderness. That's what it takes to make love grow. When you're holding hands, never let go. Being best of friends, heart and soul. Those are the things you'll need to know. That's what it takes to make love grow. The days will turn to years. There'll be laughter and some tears along the way. So trust in your heart, be honest from the start until your dying day. It's the simple things you'll learn that keeps the fire burning in your eyes. With this advice, the warmth of a smile, feel of a kiss, a little hug of sweet tenderness. That's what it takes to make love grow. When you're holding hands, never let go. Being best of friends, heart and soul. These are the things you'll need to know. That's what it takes to make love grow. The warmth of a smile, feel of a kiss, a little hug of sweet tenderness. That's what it takes to make love grow. When you're holding hands, never let go. Being best of friends, heart and soul. These are the things you need to know. That's what it takes to make love grow. That's what it takes to make love grow.
That was Donnie Parenteau with What It Takes. The Shilkotin Nation will continue to keep an eye on Taseko Mining even after the federal government rejected its prosperity mining proposal. That proposal included turning beautiful Fish Lake into a tailings pond. The community did have celebrations late last week after the federal government made its announcement. Shilkotin National Government Chief Joe Alphonse said the communities were relieved after 17 years of fighting the mining proposal.
The prosperity mine has been their proposal to develop prosperity mine has been rejected. The decision's been by the federal government to endorse its own environmental review, support its own environmental review, and deny the application as it stands.
And what does that mean to the Shilkotin Nation?
I think it means a lot. I think it it means relief immediately. The threat of our culture, the threat of our fish stocks being destroyed, our water becoming contaminated, and big industry doesn't always bring in the big jobs that everybody thinks and hopes it's going to bring it, but it will bring an increase in social issues and stuff like that. So, what does it mean for Shilkotin people? I think it means a lot. It means it's very positive that it's not going through, and we can continue to rely on our waters, our fish, continue with our way of life, be able to hunt moose, deer, and continue with that way of life without fear that we're going to become contaminated ourselves.
All right. And do you think the federal government's decision has set some sort of precedence in the province?
No, I don't think it has. I think the laws are out there protecting Aboriginal right and title. I think logging industries and industries that have been here and continue to operate to our, they're they're adhering to those regulations and working with us. The mining industry and the oil companies are in our area. They're the new kids on the block, and they're the ones that are not wanting to adhere to those regulations. Our challenge is, you know, they're like the spoiled child or whatever, and are refusing to acknowledge First Nation people and treat them in a meaningful way. And you know what? This is 2010. Maybe you want to take that 70s style approach to dealing with First Nation people. Well, you know what? You're going to be in for some tough lessons here. And you know, if that's precedent setting, that would be a sad situation, because that would mean the First Nation right across Canada are being inundated with attacks from all other industries, and I don't believe that's the case. Mining and oil and gas, they're not above law. You know, they have to adhere to these rules and regulations like any other industry.
Last week, Minister of State Randy Hawes, Minister of Mining Randy Hawes, has told media that he wasn't yet ready to declare that the project was dead, and he wants to look at it again and maybe restructure it. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, saving face. I think, you know, they have to say something. Otherwise, you know, their markets are falling through the floor. You know, it's more of a statement to keep investor interest in than anything else. Prosperity Mine is dead, and there's nothing they can do to revive that now.
Okay, fair enough. And also last week, after the federal government made its decision, your communities were celebrating that defeat of the project. And can you tell us how you celebrated?
I think we had probably about 500 people show up, Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal people alike in my community. We're centrally located in Chilcotin Territory, so there's a lot of excitement. We passed, you know, people coming in, settling in. We did some food offerings. We did some prayers, some drumming, some singing. We've had speeches from all the political leaders. We had our members, our grassroots people. We've given them a chance to come, you know, say 10-15 words, whatever, what they think of the decision and how they feel, and just allow everybody to have a say and allow everybody to have input. So, and from there we had, you know, lunch and more speeches and more singing, more drumming, and we brought a band in, and we danced into the evening.
That was Chilcotin National Government Chief Alphonse. Remembrance Day has just passed, and people throughout North America were remembering soldiers past and present who have fought in wars and are continuing to do so. In Anishinaabeg Nation territory, veterans are honored and remembered as far back as the War of 1812. And to tell us about First Nations veterans is Morris Switzer, Communications Director for the Anishinaabeg Nation.
First Nations, the people in Canada, have for hundreds of years been among the strongest defenders of what we now call Canada. And it's important for everybody to remember that beginning with the Treaty of Niagara in 1764, the First Nations people around the Great Lakes, 24 nations, agreed that they would be allied with the Crown in Canada. And because of that alliance, the First Nations of our territories here around this part of Canada and Ontario have supported the Crown in Canada, i.e. Britain, in every conflict that's taken place since. And that includes the War of 1812, in which historians tell us if it wasn't for the contributions of warriors like Tecumseh, it's almost certain that the American invasion would have succeeded, because British troops were busy being occupied in Europe fighting Napoleon. And it's almost certain that we tell people the flags that fly over the public buildings here, like our schools and our courthouses and our city halls would probably have stars and stripes on them if it weren't for the alliance with First Nations. So this isn't a modern phenomenon, and it's important for people to remember that in the War of 1812, they estimate that 15,000 First Nations peoples around the Great Lakes died. That was a huge, it represented 20% of the population in that area at the time, and then some of them died in battle, but many of them died because the Americans were burning villages of First Nations peoples near the 13 colonies. So when you move forward into the 20th century and the two world wars, that allegiance to the crown was still very much there. The crown was with whom our treaties were made, and it was the crown that said we will recognize the Indian tribes of North America, as they called us then, as nations. So we felt that obligation to continue to keep our promises that we'd made with the crown. And in the two world wars of the 20th century, an estimated 7,000 Aboriginal First Nation people enlisted. And it's really important to remember that they enlisted, they volunteered. And this was at a time when we have to remember that the government had to put a draft conscription in place to get enough soldiers for their military forces. But First Nations people, by treaty, are exempt from military service, but they volunteered in huge numbers, and the numbers in proportion to their overall population was higher than for any other identifiable group in the country. There were many reasons. Sometimes the men, it was an opportunity for gainful employment, it was a chance to see the world, the same reasons that other people want to join the services, but there was also that sense of loyalty to the crown. And it's also significant, and I don't know how many Canadians are aware of this, that among the most recognized veterans or warriors or soldiers that fought to keep Canada a nation were First Nations soldiers. In the War of 1812, of course, Tecumseh is one of the ones that's recognized, but there were many others who weren't from those 24 nations. There are many people from Manitoulin Island, leaders who contributed a lot in the War of 1812. In the First World War, Corporal Francis Pegamagabo from Wasoxing First Nation near Parry Sound received the military medal three times for gallantry, and it's an extremely rare decoration. It's probably second only to the Victoria Cross for bravery in action. And he is not only the first Aboriginal soldier, enlisted soldier, to receive that honor. He is perhaps the only person who ever fought in a Canadian uniform, enlisted man, to receive that recognition. And he came home and had a fight for his rights, like unfortunately many of our other veterans. In the Second World War and Korean Wars, Sergeant Tommy Prince from Broken Head Indian Reserve in Manitoba became one of Canada's most decorated enlisted men ever, again, for bravery in action. So we have First Nations people have a proud history of fighting for Canada, and our veterans are so respected in our communities that the first people who enter the powwow ring at our powwows are our veterans, and it's a very moving thing to see some of them coming in, you know, with walkers or, you know, in wheelchairs, but they have a place of honor in our communities, because there's no greater sacrifice than anybody can make than to be prepared to give up their life for their community and their country.
That was Morris Switzer, Communications Director for the Anishinaabeg Nation. Now here's the Slide and Clyde Band with A Long Way From Home.
boy, a long way from home. A red boy, a long way from home. I ain't got nobody, no one to call my own. A red boy, long way from home. A red boy, long way from home. Well, out to the country where my people are from. Well, I went out to the country where my people are from. Well, I couldn't find nobody, no one to call my home.
Transmission could very well become the new casinos for First Nations in Ontario, and that's according to John Bocash, president of the Lake Huron Anishinaabeg Transmission Company, a company which is just getting off the ground.
The Lake Huron Anishinaabeg Transmission Company was incorporated in January. All of the Lake Huron First Nations own the company, and we're currently working on developing the partnerships and going forward and owning transmission lines in our territory.
Are there any concerns over the political changing winds and scare tactics from the opposition, the Conservatives in this case in Ontario, saying energy costs are constantly on the rise and more construction would create more provincial debt? And does these transmission lines or your project factor at all into this?
Well, I guess that's a very picture thinking right now. And one of the things that I have to look at is that we get all of the transmission lines in Ontario right now are aging. We've seen brownouts over the past while with the current transmission lines and generation. We also know that that the coal powered plants are going to be phased out in Ontario. So I think it just makes sense to go with green energy to make sure that in the future Ontario is powered more and more by green energy rather than nuclear, rather than by coal fired plants, and rather than damming up some of our precious waterways and destroying thousands of acres of land. So green energy makes sense, and much of the green energy is in central and northern Ontario. Well, we have to have a way to bring it to the south where it's going to be used. And even though we've had a slight downturn in electrical usage in Ontario, that's a cycle. And know that economies, we know that everything goes in huge cycles. So there's going to be an upturn. And when there's an upturn, we should be ready. And Lake Huron Transmission Company is going to be in the right place.
The upturn is inevitable. Now, there are a couple of First Nation wind projects on the go in the province. And will this company at all help with that, or them help with the transmission company in any way?
Oh, I think it'll help a great deal. That we know that there's some major projects in the planning phase right now within Anishinaabeg territory. And if we have an Anishinaabeg transmission company and perhaps an Anishinaabeg services company to build lines, we know that we can work really well together, and that rather than send the jobs to somebody else, we can keep the jobs in our communities. And I think one of the long-term goals that we all have.
Okay, the other thing that you were saying during your presentation is that the energy and transmission would be new casinos for First Nation communities. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think it really gets down to where's our opportunities to develop economies in our community. In the States, they developed casinos. They had that opportunity through various Supreme Court decisions back to the 1890s. Well, we've had a Supreme Court decision in 2004 with Haida Taku, and then followed up by Mikisew, which requires consultation and accommodation when there's development in our territory. So that gives us an opportunity to get involved. And electrical transmission is one thing. Oil pipeline or gas pipeline might be another, and maybe even eventually forestry. But the thing of it is, if it happens in our territory, we have to be involved. And unlike what has happened over the past 100 years, where there's things that have gone on, development, and we didn't get any benefit, we have to benefit from now on into the future.
Which brings me to, how would the First Nation communities involved with the transmission company benefit from it?
Well, for one thing, very basically, there is an opportunity to be on the decision making for what happens with the companies. There is also an opportunity to get jobs. And then thirdly will be the opportunity to have long-term revenue stream from these various companies. Because when you have a transmission line, that transmission line is there for 60 to 80 years. And there's a revenue stream that will come out of this for 60 to 80 years, and a really good revenue stream. So I think it's right, and it will work out for us.
How close do you think you'd be to obtaining contracts for any of the, was it 12 projects in the province?
Yes, there's about 12 projects over the next 10 years as being in preliminary planning. I think we're probably 18 months away from being a designated transmitter and working to that end.
So we'll briefly look at the final picture, because you guys basically have no money. So how is that going to work out in the big picture of things?
Makes it really tough to do anything right now. We've had lawyers, we've had all kinds of people advising us, and they've been doing it on speculation. Speculation that we will get funded in the near future. We've had a number of discussions with government about this, and we're working on it. And we've had a little bits of money that have helped us along from various sources. And that's keeping our heads above water, but it's not a lot of money. So we need to get some infusion of pre-development money pretty soon.
Okay, well, one of the main goals is to make money for communities. But I also found what was interesting is that you will be developing or having an elders committee to help guide the way.
Yes, that was one of the things that we talked about right off with any of the people that we've been dealing with, is that we believe that we still can't lose touch with our own cultural roots and our own ways of doing things. And so an elders committee is really important to be involved, to provide us with advice and to make sure that we don't get going along a road that we shouldn't be, that they will be a sober second thought to some of the business decisions that we will make, to make sure that we're not infringing upon land or cultural locations, spiritual locations, or doing things that we shouldn't be doing.
That was John Bokash, president of the Lake Huron Anishinaabeg Transmission Company. Most people said in a recent national poll that the British were the principal founders of Canada. The poll of 1,500 Canadians was commissioned by the Montreal-based Association for Canadian Studies. But the study also showed French and English-speaking citizens have different views of about who is responsible for creating the country. Despite that, it is noted that there are many Indigenous nations across the country who had occupied Canada long before the arrival of the European colonizers. In the survey, 42% said the British were the principal founders of Canada, 20% chose the French, and only 18% answered that Indigenous nations played a key role. David Newhouse is the chair of Indigenous Studies at Trent University, and he says he wasn't surprised at the poll's results.
It's not surprising, right? I mean, we firmly believe, or at least the two founding nations' idea of Canada has been around for a very long time. And so most Canadians are taught that the country was founded by the British and the French. So that's the idea that's taught in public school, that's the idea that's taught in high school, and it's only when people come to university that they begin to have at least that challenge. But that idea is still very, very strong. What is surprising is that there is at least a sense now that Aboriginal people have played a role. Right? I mean, 20%, so one out of five people now say that Aboriginal people played a role in the founding of Canada. And so I think that's quite interesting. That represents quite a shift. The study also indicates that young people are more inclined to give a larger role to Aboriginal people than to older people. So I think that's quite interesting as well, and I think that's quite important. So our ideas about how the country has been founded and who are the founding peoples of the country are, I think, in the shift. I've always thought of Canada as Canada in the process of continuing to be confederated, right, of continuing to be formed. Right? And I saw the Royal Commission of Aboriginal People present a model for continuing confederation. The Nunavut is also a model for continuing confederation. And some of the land claims, right, you can begin to think in terms of continuing confederation because they begin to shape the fabric and the structure of the country by creating a political place in the governance of the country for Aboriginal people. And so I think that what the survey represents is some of these ideas beginning to become part of public consciousness.
Right, and when we were talking about that portion of the younger people that were polled, it was about set at 25%, I think, that they chose that Indigenous people were, you know, principal founders of the country. And do you think that the education system has anything to do with that shift in thinking?
I think so. You know, right across the country, there's been quite an attempt to begin to present Aboriginal people as contemporary people who have made a contribution. Right? I mean, Cora Voyager, Dan Bevan, and I have prepared a 2-volume text that talks about Aboriginal contributions to Canada and Canadian identity that focuses very much upon the contribution of Aboriginal people. And we've been talking about the idea that Aboriginal people made a fundamental contribution to Canada through the treaty process, even though some people say it was forced, and it may have been forced, and a lot of difficulties surrounding it, but there still is that contribution. So in those sorts of ideas, that idea of contribution is beginning, I think, to be seen in history as it's taught in public schools. Now, I have some friends who are teachers, and they're constantly looking for new material that begins to present a very different view of Aboriginal people.
Well, certainly. And in Ontario, we have the Ipperwash Inquiry, where different educational boards in the province have been trying to implement more First Nations education. But do you think in the future, with continued education on Aboriginal issues and Aboriginal contributions in the country, that we could see a statistic like that change or get higher?
Well, I'm hoping that over time it will get higher. Right? And we also have John Ralston Saul, who is writing in his book, A Fair Country, where he talks about Canada being a Métis country. Right? It's Canada being comprised, right? Or the Canadian political culture as being fundamentally informed by Indigenous ideas. Right? In his previous work, he also talked about Canada as being founded on three pillars. Right? So even in the public sphere, he writes for the public to a large extent, this idea is beginning to be seen as important and something that needs to be explored and developed. I think what we'll see over the next short while is some sense of contribution and probably more nuanced discussion about contribution. You know, our ideas about Canada, about how Canada is formed, are constantly in the process of changing.
That was David Newhouse, Chair of Indigenous Studies at Trent University. Now here's Buffy St. Marie with Blue Sunday.
Riverside, letting my head hang low. Really let my heart hang down. Boy, I really cry. Since my baby left me, feel like I could die. And it's Blue Sunday. Saturday night ain't nothing to me, just a memory of blue. Since my baby left me, I don't go to town. I go down by the riverside, let my head hang down. Really let my heart hang low. Boy, I really pray. Since my baby left me, lonesome every day. And it's Blue Sunday. Saturday night ain't nothing to me, just a memory of blue. Play blue, boy.
Is the opening act of a play by Mariel Miguel called Throwaway Kids. It's being performed by Penny Coochie of Nipissing First Nation, her partner Sid Bob, and their daughter Nimke. It's being performed as a part of a grand opening of their small art studio in Nipissing First Nation in Ontario. This is something the couple, who have a long history in the world of drama, wanted to give to their community. Penny says they moved to her community to do just that.
We moved here to Nipissing, my husband and I and our two kids, about 4 years ago, and with the aging work in the community, with bringing arts, what we're doing in the arts to this community, but also with the aim of seeking out those other artists that are already in the community and collaborating with them. And so in the time that we've been here, one of the big needs for us was to have a place for that, have a home for that. So we built this studio to do dance and to do theater and to do the work that we're hoping to do in the future.
But before the studio's opening, Penny says they invited a very important mentor to help them out.
I guess logical steps for us was to bring in a woman who we've both who's made a big impression on us and who we've both mentored with for many years, Muriel Miguel, to work with us and share this opening with us in the community.
Bob, Penny's husband, adds the new studio will also be open to other artists and venues. Plus, he says the studio will host a salon series over the next year.
We owe a lot of gratitude to one of our former company members, Tanya Lukin Linklater, who brought forth this idea of wanting to create a salon series here. And from what she expressed in Edmonton, she was a part of these kind of really works development where artists would get together and share their work and just present it and talk about it and create common understanding in aesthetic and purpose. So that's really what this is. It's for us to put forth our work, just share why we do it, and hopefully that'll be a catalyst to open our imaginations about each other and create a awareness and understanding. And hopefully from there we can partner a little bit more and be aware of each other in the community.
She was small, she was large, she was smooth, she was rough, she was beautiful. She was beautiful. She was beautiful. She was not beautiful. Long, 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 long. Long, long time ago.
Speaking of baby love, the couple's daughter, Animke Kwakuchi, is 16 years old, and she performed alongside her parents in the dance drama of Throwaway Kids. It was the first time she performed in her community with her parents, and for her, it was absolutely wonderful.
It was a really special experience. Like, I've performed with my parents before at the Capitol Center and a few other times, but I think experience was a lot different. I don't know, it was a longer process, so I spent a lot more time rehearsing with them, and like I got a lot of one-on-one time with them like showing me how to like just taking me through each of the movements and what the movements mean. And just like your form and your body, when you, like my mom, because she's a dancer, she helped me a lot with learning the different movements. And I was just really excited to perform today. And I when it ended, I just have a really good feeling.
And Miriam Miguel, who acted as mentor to the group, is the artistic director of Spider-Woman Theater, which was founded in 1975 and is the longest-running Native American feminist theater group in North America. She founded the theater group with her sisters, and that's something she really admires about the Nipissing First Nation family. They open a theater group together and a studio in the community.
I think they are very brave. They are very brave young people. They have put together their careers with their culture and their families. And to me, that is really brave. It means that you do the whole circle. And sometimes it happens together. Sometimes it's piecemeal. And I think it's wonderful, you know, that they have this big medicine studio. How wonderful, you know, and that they can bring people in. How wonderful, and that their group have all different ages. That is something that's really, you know, wonderful. and that they're really going into the community, really really listening. And that's one of the things I think is really commendable, listening. Because listening doesn't happen that much. You know, people come in, they want to be Christians, they want to change the community. They don't listen. They just hear their egos go. And that these young people are listening. You know, how wonderful.
Big Medicine Studio held its official grand opening November 5th in Nipissing First Nation.
Sovereignty is that lofty thread securing the development of society. Sovereignty runs through the vertical strands and secures the entire capital. That is the capital of Native society.
You've been listening to Bomb Siddell with Jennifer Ashwasage. Bomb Siddell is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Siddell means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsiddell.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-B-A. And thanks for listening to Bomb Siddell.